Hello and welcome to Drive the Bid, brought to you by AutoHunter.com, which is our online auction, which has cars going live every single weekday. So if you're interested in buying or selling your collector car, be sure to check out AutoHunter.com. Now, I am Jeff Sutton, and I'm joined by Derek Shakey on the left and Diego Rosenberg over here on the right.
Hello,
and
Jeff.
Today, we have a fantastic video. We're going to talk about a little bit of car news, and then we're going to go into our main topic, which is actually focused on our favorite sort of car features and gimmicks, and then we'll go ahead and highlight some of our favorite cars currently live on the AutoHunter.com website. But before we get into that, we do have a sponsor, and that is Land Air Sea. So today's episode of Drive the Bid is brought to you by Land Air Sea. Keep tabs on all of your valuable assets from the palm of your hand. Remember, with Land Air Sea, theft is temporary. Visit LandAirSea.com to order your Land Air Sea GPS unit for your classic vehicle. And to make sure we don't lose our Camaro here, this is where I'll leave our Land Air Sea GPS unit. So yeah, with that, let's go ahead and let's get into our first piece of news, which is this Bentley.
Yes. Not just this Bentley, but also the Continental GT as a whole and the W12. So this marks the 20th year of the Continental GT and the W12. So the first Continental GT left the production line in Crewe in 2003. That was a cypress green model with a saddle leather interior with burr walnut accents. Classic combo. Mm-hmm. Of course, Bentley still has that. And to commemorate this occasion, they're going to release a couple of different special Continental GT models. So one that they introduced at the Shanghai Auto Show was a one-of-one model. It was a Continental GTS. So that was magnetic, that color right there. It's a dark gray metallic. It's got red accents and brake calipers. And then the inside, it's Beluga and Hotspur with piano black trim. So basically, you know, the neutral black theme inside as well. And then black 22-inch wheels, and then there's a variety of commemorative accents and door sill plates.
Yeah, I think it's important to butt in real quick and point out that Bentley's not murdering whales when they say beluga leather. That is not whale leather that they're using in these cars. It's standard leather that is just, I guess, described from wherever where it comes from, or like the type of conditioning, I believe, that it goes through to become beluga leather, right?
So what color is beluga? Is it red, black, or gray?
You know, I've seen some other Bentleys that had light gray interiors that said they had beluga leather. I don't know if the color, though, determines if it's beluga leather or not. I think it's a conditioning thing. Well, and how like Alcantara is still leather, but it's different type.
From what I gathered about this is it's the color. So Beluga and Hotspur.
Oh, that's
so
definitely the gray.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, Hotspur implies red here. So, yeah. High contrast combo there. And then, of course, you got the two tiers of different media on the dash and the door panels as well.
Yeah, Bentley is quite a manufacturer when it comes to the materials they use. They have the Bacalar, which is one of 12. It's a Mulliner car that comes with 5,000-year-old river wood that they pulled out of a bog, which is pretty interesting. So Bentley spares no expense when it comes to materials, except the bog wood was probably free, so on the Bacalar. But that's not the case in the GTS.
Was it sitting in a well for those years?
I have probably. It says preserved by bogs. So whatever that means. I'm not overly familiar with England's landscape and how they treat their bogs differently. I have no idea. But I thought this was cool too, because this has the two different, obviously, main body lines that we think of when it comes to the Continental. So that's a pretty cool feature, I thought.
Yeah, exactly. To mark the, you know, the there's actually three generations, but obviously, you know, it's more symmetrical to put the bookends of the Continental GT.
It's the first and the current, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, there's been three generations. And then as part of the festivities, they're also going to release another one-of-one Continental GT speed model inspired by the very first production model of the Continental GT. That's going to debut at Monterey Car Week, which runs August 11th through the 18th.
Neat. That's pretty cool. Bentley does some cool stuff, especially now that Mulliner has been brought back. So cool. Thank you there, sir. This one is mine. So this is the 2024 McLaren 750S, which was just announced yesterday as of making this video. And I included a little snapshot of the 720S in the top right there, so you can see some of the differences, because obviously they're very similar cars. This still uses the twin turbo 4-liter V8. It's now making 740 horsepower. If you don't know McLaren, the numbers on the side generally tell you the horsepower, but in whatever the European PS, so you do the math and it comes out about 740 US and 590 pound-feet of torque. And it features a 7-speed dual clutch auto with shorter gearing, which is essentially supposed to be similar to the one that's in the 765, which was the replacement for the 720. And then 0 to 60 is around 2.7 seconds with pricing starting at $330,000. And it's not an extreme departure from the styling department. There's a few things that are different, like this exhaust that's in the back. You can see the sort of central exhaust. That there is one of the main different features. Some people were kind of making fun of it and calling names, which I'm sure you don't have to be too imaginative to figure out what they might be calling that.
Can already think of one right now.
The diffuser, I think, is slightly different. Obviously, different wheels. And I believe that MSO, McLaren Special Operations, also announced a special livery that would be available for these cars as well if you have the extra cash. Which is funny, because why would you buy a 750S over a 765 LT? The 765 LT has more power, right? And it's the other improved version. Maybe this one's just newer. Maybe you collect McLarens, I guess. But the part that kills me about this car is McLaren, you know, really shows it off as being the next step in ultimate driver performance and driver feel. And just cracks me up, because it feels like every car that comes out, you know, is, hey, this is a more pure driving experience than the last car.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, that's kind of marketing speak. You know, they kind of remind me of how Aston Martin was in the early 2000s, because all of the cars were attractive. This is not a bad looking car. It's swoopy. It's got a drama to it, a lot of curves. Mm-hmm. But like those Aston Martins, it seems like all of the McLarens now, they all look the same. They're kind of hard to tell apart. Mm-hmm. I think it's even more so than it was with Aston Martin, because with those, you could definitely see the family resemblance and the influence on, you know, the models, subsequent models. But these modern McLarens, it's really hard for me to tell them apart.
Yeah, like I said, that's why I added the 720S there, but the differences are pretty subtle. So the 765 is a little bit more obvious. It has more carbon. It's got vents in the fenders and things like that. This, the main thing in, from the front, is kind of that front splitter sticks out way more on the 750 than it does on the 720, but they're pretty similar. Some people say the 750 looks a little bit more like slabby on the sides and things like that, but the rear, I think, will be pretty obvious. The 765 LT has four exhaust pipes in the center, and so obviously the two in the center there will be a little bit more obvious, and then the little vents in the corner is a little bit different. So quick look at it. It's not affordable, I won't be planning on buying one anytime soon.
I'll say this, though. I mean, as similar as so many of them look, it's great that, you know, they went from being basically a one-off manufacturer of the F1 in the 90s to what is, I wouldn't say a full-line manufacturer, but I mean, they've definitely had a long run, you know, for a specialized car manufacturer, and they have a broad array of various models now.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that all worked out, right? Obviously, Bruce McLaren started a race team and then unfortunately passed away while racing. And then the company kind of changed, and then I believe the F1 is generally considered a Gordon Murray car, just built by McLaren, if that makes sense, because Gordon Murray didn't have his own resources to obviously build the cars.
And who's Gordon Murray?
The designer, the McLaren F1, he's worked with both McLaren and I'm spacing the other name. Basically, he designed Formula One cars for like a long time, a ton of race cars, lots of winning race cars. Now he owns his own company. And he's building his own car called the Gordon Murray T50. And there's also a T30. You might be getting the numbers wrong in the second car, but he's got his own new car that everybody is hailing as the new F1. But discussion for another time. We could talk about McLaren or even Aston Martin for that matter for a long time. All right, Diego.
Okay, this gentleman, I think his last name is pronounced Reuss, R-E-U-S-S. So,
Rolls. Yeah.
So, anyway, he passed away recently. I think he was 86. He was born in 1936. He was a General Motors engineer from the 1950s who eventually became a suit in General Motors. And he was general manager of Buick in the 80s, which in some ways could be considered the good years. He pushed the turbo, supposedly. I wasn't able to find out for sure exactly. I mean, he was around. Whether he was a proponent, I don't know. But he also pushed the EV1 that GM did in the 90s. So I would say, yeah, as an engineering guy, he probably was trying to be ahead of the curve when it came to propulsion. He, in 1990 to 92, he was General Motors president, and then he was let go with a lot of other people who were purged around that time in the 90s, and he got into nonprofits, and that's what he's been doing from the 90s until now. So he just passed away and thought it was worth mentioning.
Sure. All right. With that, that's going to be the end of the news. So it's time to move on to our main topic, which we've already got our first feature on the screen here. We're going to be taking a look at some of our favorite sort of features and gimmicks. I'm using the word gimmicks. I don't know if you guys do, because some of them, I'm not sure how functional they are, often like the air grabber here. But I'll go ahead and go first. So this is the air grabber found on Plymouths, or the Ram Charger for the Dodge equivalent. So what this is essentially a vacuum operated, there was a switch by your right knee inside the car. You flick it, vacuum operated switch that would pump out this vent that would help ram air or grab air and throw it into your engine. So supposedly to add more horsepower, whether or not it was overly effective, I think is eh. But I think it's a cool feature. I know that I saw people telling stories that supposedly you could pull up next to somebody at a light and then flick the switch, and then they would get a, you know, like an oh no face. Like, a, oh no, I didn't realize you had the air grabber or the Ram Charger package. And personally, I prefer the Plymouth one because I think the air grabber logo is cooler. Like the B is cool on the Ram Charger. But I think there's just the presentation of the air grabber reminds me of like 1940s, you know, World War II aircraft, the P-40 Warhawk and stuff. And so I just, I like the air grabber. So that's kind of on my bucket list as well. Got to have a Plymouth with the air grabber system, even though it looks like it weighs like a pretty hefty amount under the hood. And it's got a whole mechanism and obviously the extra vacuum lines running to everything. So I'm not sure the 1 or 2 horsepower gain you might get is worth the 20 pounds of weight that maybe you add, but who knows? Maybe if you know better than us, you can always throw a comment down below and let us know if you beat your buddy in his non-air grab or Ram Charger car. So
one thing's for sure, it adds a ton of style.
Oh, all the style. It adds all of the style. Yeah, I think these things are great. And they had limited availability, as I'm sure Diego knows all the insights to, as far as what engines you could or could not get the air grabber Ram Charger on as well.
Well, I mean, you could get it for, it was available on the 383, the 440, and the Hemi. It was standard on the Hemi, but, you know, they made a decent amount of them.
Oh, and this is also a good point to point out that we do have a video on a B coming. Roadrunner coming with a air grabber. So that'll be on the Auto Hunter YouTube channel as a find as well. I believe it's in B5 Blue. So that'll be coming. So get subscribed if you don't want to miss that.
Okay. So that brings us to these little devices here. Some people refer to them as semaphores. Others refer to them as trafficators. And these are actually on a car that's for sale on our sister site, classiccars.com. This is a 1952 Volkswagen Beetle. A lot of cars in the earlier parts of the 20th century had these sort of crude turn signal indicators. So on the Beetle, I think they phased these out probably late 50s, early 60s. But on the Beetle, you know, you when you wanted to signal left or right, you would do that, and then this actual mechanical part would actually flip up from behind the door. And these appear to be, you know, just bright, maybe reflective, but I've seen some online where, you know, they're actually there's an actual light in there, and then there's a company, I'm sure there's various other companies, that sell LEDs in kits to where you can make the actual element blink to indicate where you're turning.
I believe the one on the left has the light.
Okay, yeah. See, I couldn't tell if that was reflective or is it an actual light. But
yeah, so I'm not a Volkswagen guy, but if the light was ever a factory thing in those at one point, that seems like a way more complicated engineering way of doing that, especially because you wouldn't be able to see that if you were on the other side of the car. If you had a four-way stop and they were turning left and you were on their right, you wouldn't be able to see that indicator. So that seems like a way more complicated way to add turn signals, try and indicate. Like, I would argue doing the bike thing, you know, might be easier.
Yeah, yeah.
And at a stop sign.
I think I read somewhere that, yeah, you know, that was something that was more effective, was just using hand signals. And another thing, too, is the mechanism, you know, that area could end up being caked with grime and dirt and everything and kind of, you know, not actually work. It would either stay closed or stay open. You know?
Good.
But I will say this, however crude and low tech it is, one thing I like about it is, even though it's not as literally flashy as modern, you know, alternatives to it, there's got to be that sense of occasion to actually using it, you know, because it's a relic now. You know what I mean? So if you're driving around in one of those,
you pop out of your car either.
Exactly.
Like that.
Except the air grabber hood, I guess.
Well, that's true, but that's only when you pull up, like a hood scoop popping up at the front or like a active aero wing at the back, where like we almost expect these days. But like something out of the side of your cars, we're especially not used to. But that's, God, those are wild. You know, seeing those pop out makes the Beetle look a lot more like a bug.
I see what you did there.
don't quote me on this, but I believe that these were carried into the mid-50s, but U.S. regulations started requiring turn signals in 56, I think.
I could believe it, yeah.
And
we will return to this topic in a few minutes, which you'll see.
Right, right. All right, Diego.
Okay, I try to think of something interesting, and this is what I came up with. From 63 to 65, AMC had this shifter, the twin stick floor shifter. It used an overdrive system on 2 out of the 3 gears. So it's a 3-speed manual with 2 gears having overdrive. Now, I was trying to figure out how this worked. I thought it was kind of like the old Dodge Colts from the early 80s, but I think how this works is the right one activates, it turns on and off the overdrive. So you just leave that, you just like push it up, maybe for on, I'm not sure where on is. Let's say you push it up, and then otherwise on the left, you have a standard 3-speed gear shift, and there's a button on the top where you actually activate the overdrive. So it's not like this, the thing of the Dodge Colt where you'd like, you need octopus arms to try to do 2 things at once. This thing's pretty simple, unfortunately.
Well, I wonder what the actual mechanism looked like for the transmission itself as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm assuming it's just, you know, very simple.
Because it's an automatic transmission, right?
No, it's a 3-speed manual.
Oh.
It looks like a slot there.
That's, I was going to say, it looks like a slot.
But it's 3-speed.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely a 3-speed.
Real narrow.
I was going to say, this is a photo of the actual car, not the brochure, and you can see it's a little bit more obvious that it's a manual there. You can see first in the bottom left.
So it looks more interesting than what it is, because most of the overdrive actuation is with the button on the left, a stalk.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting way of doing this. I think the C4 Corvette with the Doug Nash 4+3 might have done it a little bit better, although I have heard that if you buy one of those cars, it's hard to find one that has the overdrive working well, which I know was an addition. So you had what was essentially your standard GM 4-speed, and then they just attached the overdrive part onto it. So you shifted through your 4 speeds, and then once you got into 4th, you could then get access to the overdrive gears. So that's hence the +3 part. A little weird. This is seems like a much more horrific way of doing that. My question is why do you think people kept looking into all these different ways to keep low transmission numbers rather than making it like a 6-speed or something and just always leave 1 gear for overdrive and giving more gears for shifting?
I don't know. I can't say I know much about old transmissions, but I think overdrive was kind of a complement to the transmission and not something that was inside the transmission itself. maybe.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, I would say, the gearing of how you decide to do your transmission gears, which is why I'm curious what this does where they make it available, right? If it's acting like it's a normal three-speed unless you hit the lever, then what does the lever do? So that's interesting. That's anybody that's driven one of these, we know how it works. We would like to know. So go ahead and let us know down below. But yeah, very quirky. Makes you think it would be four-wheel drive, even though it's not. So this is one of mine again. This is the Chevrolet Flowtie, which is a modified Chevrolet bowtie. So obviously, if you can't tell, this is all hollow in the middle of the bowtie. And essentially, this was first developed for the 2014 Chevrolet Camaro Z28. And it was developed by a powertrain cooling development engineer, named Richard Quinn, which noticed the bowtie was displacing air from the radiator, and he used a cutoff wheel to create a prototype of the Flowtie. And then after using their solution, they even created this super cool little graph here to point out that the solution gives them up to 3 cubic meters of air per minute, which lowered the engine coolant and oil temperatures by 2 degrees, which I think is pretty impressive for something you can do just with an air cutting wheel and not altering the look of the car too much. But kind of a fun graphic and totally unnecessary, I think. You know, like, obviously you always want the optimal performance, but I love the Flowtie because it's something they can do without altering the shape, right? If you're looking at this car from 50 feet, you won't even notice that the badge is hollow, right? You're just going to be like, oh yeah, that's a Chevrolet bowtie, you know, fear the bowtie. As of right now, I believe there are 13 or 14 vehicles that are available with the Flowtie. So the main ones being the Camaros, you can get the Z28 or the ZL1 came with this. But then there's actually a few trucks. There's some HD heavy-duty trucks, some ZR2s, and then even that Beast off-road thing that Chevrolet built. Like, they unveiled it, everybody was like, what is this? And then you never heard about it again. That thing also has it too, apparently. So pretty interesting. Totally, well, I say totally unnecessary. It adds performance. It does. The cooling reduction is a pretty big deal. Although some of the later Camaros that have this bumper with the current gen facelift, the Chevy badge is now in the middle of that bar with the way they changed the looks, and it's still hollowed out in the bar. But part of me is like laughing because they could have done more with the bar, I would think, even though, again, I'm sure that's where the main structure impact bar is. But a pretty cool thing. Just as far as weird engineering quirks, you know, it doesn't seem like it would be a big deal. It seems like it almost would be an aesthetic choice, right? But so you get some performance out of it nonetheless. So there you go, the Chevrolet Flowtie, which is the official GM engineering look into that new bow tie. I thought that was pretty fun.
Okay, so this is pretty cool as well, literally. So in 1984, for the Toyota Van LE model, one of the options was an actual ice maker. So, you know, there are vehicles out there like the Grand Wagoneer, the Lexus LX, that offer a cool box between the two front seats.
Yep.
Mercedes, they have heated and cooled cup holders.
But these are modern cars.
Yeah, exactly. But I've, you know, and I've driven vehicles that have those features, but I never knew there was an actual vehicle with an ice maker. It was about the size of a shoebox. It had the refrigerant lines and what I've seen called spill-free ice cube trays.
The AC in this car must be ice cold if they're going to have an ice maker. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't just have an ice maker and then have, like, subpar AC.
True. Now, this begs the question, how many cup holders were in this van?
That is an important question. We've actually reviewed some vehicles that had as many as 14.
Yeah, which seems to be more of a modern thing. It seems like as time goes on, more cup holders are added to vehicles. I can't imagine there was a ton in this vehicle given its age, but I would hope there are enough to, you know, actually make use of that thing.
Yeah, I certainly wish more of my old cars had cup holders, or even usable cup holders for that matter. You know, it's a shame they didn't take into account the big gulp cups. But then, yeah, even my 944, I wish had just at least, like, you know, one cup holder would go a long way, you know, for those open drinks. So this one better have cup holders if it's gonna dare have an ice maker in it.
Can this give you crushed ice?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. So you might have to bring your own.
Rumor has it, if you get in a car accident, you get crushed ice.
And other stuff too.
That's pretty cool, though. I mean, especially to see it on an older vehicle, because like you mentioned, there are a lot of vehicles that have cooling devices, you know, or drink storage. Well, that'll keep it cool for you. But seeing a literal ice maker, which I don't think exists in anything currently.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in modern times. I mean, I didn't even know about this until recently. Shout out to one of our big bosses, Mike. He was, you know, I'd come across this preparing for this episode, and then I was talking to him about what we were going to do, and he actually brought this up. So, you know, it was meant to be. Oh, so cool. There you go, Mike. Yeah.
It looks like it comes handy to keep your beer cold.
Yeah. Until you get to the party and open it, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, not to be consumed while driving.
Okay, so back to the shifter thing. This transmission is a Bendix Magic Hand, and I believe this one's on a Accord 1936-1937.
Also a weird car.
I think it's a great car.
Well,
I mean, that doesn't mean it's weird. Something great can be weird, you know?
Yeah, all of the Citroens.
yeah, true. So it's my understanding how this works is in first gear. Right now it's in first gear, down like that for the four gears. It's a conventional clutch. You know, you put in the clutch, put it in first, let go. And then every other successive gear, let's say you put the shift, you slide the shifter into two. And whenever you want to get into second gear, you press in the clutch.
So you like pre-shift.
Yes, it's a pre-selector. There's also some transmissions that are, well, okay, Hudson had a similar transmission, but also I know some cars, I think they're European, they had electromagnetic shifters, which are pre-selectors also, but they use some kind of magnetic thing. Maybe the pre-selector would move something and the magnets would go with it, and then you press the clutch and then it actuates. I have no idea, but that's pretty much how this worked.
Yeah, that thing is funky looking, not to mention the funkiness that if this is a Accord, you'd have your pop-up headlights as well then, right, to scare people with as they couldn't see your headlights.
You can see the lever there for the headlights.
Yeah.
Probably for the left light and another one for the right, I imagine.
Did the Accord sell very well? I don't think it did, right?
No.
Probably because there was too much weird stuff. What are these hidden headlights? And
I think they had trouble building it to meet demand, among other things.
Hmm.
Yeah, this is a little odd, but I love, you know, it's all metal. It's a little funky, but it, again, you know, just like the Trafficators, there's a sense of occasion just looking at this, you know?
It makes my brain hurt. what kills me is like all the shifting lines don't look consistent. And then do you know if there's a lockout for reverse?
I imagine
there's not, but you know, first, reverse looks way easier than first, second.
Yeah, it's a bit squiggly right there.
We're going to a dinner party? I'm not sure if I really want to. Oh, no, the transmission.
Can't go now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's cool about this is you don't have to remove your hands from the steering wheel.
I mean, technically, you still do to shift it, right?
Well, if you're just like, I don't know.
Yeah, it looks like it's like fairly, it looks like it's no bigger than your fist looking at it next to the steering wheel.
Maybe even smaller than that, maybe.
Yeah. Would it fit in a bread box? Or an ice box and the Toyota.
Oh, that'd definitely fit.
All right.
Okay, so this is a picture of a Mercedes AMG GLS 63, and this brings me to my third and final feature. So modern cars, you have all these sensors, all of these various devices that are meant to be convenient and helpful, but they're not exactly the best things to have engaged when you go through a car wash. So Mercedes has an available feature, car wash mode. So you just hit a button. And it's kind of blurry, but it changes a variety of settings to get your vehicle ready for an automatic car wash. So, for instance, it'll raise the vehicle up. It'll fold the mirrors in. It'll turn off the parking sensors. That's kind of
helpful. The mirrors is a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want those back.
Most cars that I've driven that have the folding mirrors, there's a button usually in the door that'll let you fold that anyways, right?
Yes. And that brings me to one standout element about this. Is this feature necessary?
No, of course not.
Yeah. Is it nice?
It's a gimmick.
And it is in a luxury vehicle. And to me, this is very much a luxury feature because it does, you know, a certain amount of work for you so that you don't have to worry about it. You know, to me, that's true luxury right there. You could do it yourself.
Sure.
But you don't have to. You just hit a button, does all of that for you.
It looks like some of the things that it turns off are things that you just shouldn't be touching anyways while you're in a car wash. Like, it looks like it turns the wipers off. Turning the rain sensor off is probably a good one in a day where the car already does everything for you. Might as well just turn off things that might have it react awkwardly. But this is interesting. My question is if you put it in car wash mode and then something still happens at the car wash, who takes responsibility for that? Would Mercedes take responsibility for that? Or are they pretty much just like, look, you use car wash mode at your own risk, all right?
Well,
I
think it depends on, you know, what actually happens there. Because I remember I was in a car wash and, you know, they tell you, oh, you put a neutral, foot off the brake, hands off the wheel, right? I did all of that. And they had some sort of shutdown and car ended up rolling into the guy in front of me. So, so I think I was in a press car at the time and they ended up contacting the car wash. So I guess the car wash ended up, you know, dealing with the other guy's insurance company.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah. But it's...
And do you know how easy it is to get to this menu?
Yeah, I mean, you got to do a little bit of diving in, but, you know, once you're there, I mean, just like a lot of, you know, modern cars, particularly like, you know, Mercedes and BMW cars, it seems like certain features are, you know, a little, you got to dive through the menus a little bit. But, you know, again, this is not a feature that you use every day, but once you're there, you know, it's touch and go.
You know, the diving part would annoy the hell out of me. My car has rain sensors on it, and it's always off because I don't want to have to adjust it when I go in the car wash.
Rain sensors would have been a good one because they started putting that stuff on cars in like the late 50s, right? Like the Cadillacs in 1958, you could get the rain sensor, which was the big prominent sort of all-seeing eye in the center of the dash.
I think the all-seeing eye is for the high beams.
Oh, sure.
I think maybe there was some kind of plate on the fender that was that could sense moisture, something like that.
Huh.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, Cadillacs aren't really my thing either. But that's, you know, speaking of Mercedes, one of the things that I'm so upset I'm thinking of it now, since you brought up Mercedes, is the bounce mode that gets you out of sand. It's supposed to get you unstuck from sand, but it's, let's be honest, it's just a much funnier, makes for a much funnier video experience. So what it is it's limited for the SUV models that'll never go off-road only. So that way when they get stuck in sand, which they won't, it could bounce out of it. So what it does is it has these like airbag suspension that it can like rock, it starts bouncing itself.
That sounds like it could be cool in a hip hop video.
Yes, and that's exactly what it got used for. Oh yeah, and it can actually drive at like, I don't know, up to like 8 miles an hour or something like that. So you can actually like, you know, bump with it in a parking lot, and it just kind of cruises along.
Is it called the Snoop mode?
I don't remember what it's called. It's probably just sand mode or something, but that's exactly what it's for. I'm convinced that they did it just because they're like, this is going to break the internet. They're like, we're going to do it.
Yeah, and a lot of people, were posting TikTok videos with that in action. You know, it was on social media a lot. And I think the purpose behind it is, or, you know, how it works is, let's say you're stuck in sand, it starts hopping. I think it's supposed to, like, get fresh
sand under you.
Yeah, yeah. So you can, you know, stand a better chance of getting traction.
It's like, hey, you're stuck in quicksand, but at least you can bump the car to good music while you're...
What a way to go.
Yeah, while you're waiting.
He went in style.
Is it synced to any kind of music? Because that'd be kind of cool.
No, it's not, unfortunately. It might even be inconsistent. I don't know how the system works. I'm not a Mercedes engineer, but it definitely seems like a lot to engineer. And I'd also assume that it, you know, takes away from your suspension life, your airbag life, I would assume. But all right, I have a Countach on the screen.
And I know what color that is.
What is the
it's,
color?
It's cocaine white over a nosebleed red interior. but moving on. So the coolest part about the Lamborghini Countach is there is a, the words are, portable vanity mirror. and it is detachable from the Lamborghini Countach. And so what that looks like is this little guy here. And so obviously it comes in on the sun visor.
Helps like, powder your
like
nose.
A, yep, like a your normal mirror on your sun visor. And it's detachable in the Countach. And one might lead you to believe that you could do certain nefarious things with a free vanity mirror, but it's mostly for powdering your nose.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff, the accessory to go with that costs $100 and you got to roll it up yourself.
Right. But that's pretty much it. I did have some honorable mentions I wanted to mention real fast. I was going to cover Rolls-Royce, both the umbrella in the door, which I think is hilarious, and then the Starliner, the Starlight headliner, because I know that people keep replicating that in their own cars. And so I thought it was kind of funny that Rolls-Royce set a trend for like modifying your vehicles a certain way. It's not typically what I think of in terms of who trend sets things for the automotive community, but I thought that was pretty cool. And then there's the S650 remote rev, which is the first time we've ever seen something like that in a vehicle. You're going to be able to rev your 2024 Mustang from a key fob, which could either destroy car events everywhere or could add a cool flex when you remote start your car and then rev it in your driveway. Who knows? I don't know.
Just let it warm up first.
Just let it warm up first. So that's pretty much it for our main arena. Now we're going to move on to some of the beautiful cars that are currently live on our online auction, AutoHunter.com. So who's first?
This one is me. Speaking of flex, I mean, I'm not really an Impala guy, but I got to say the color just immediately grabbed me. So this is Tasco turquoise, and you got the white accent there. This has been upgraded with a 350. It's got a TH350 three-speed automatic. Once you get past the color, just the lines, you know, it's got a certain drama to it, a certain flow, certain grace. Really, really digging this one, especially with the white walls. You know, that's a nice contrast, ties in with the trim. Great looking car.
It looks like they installed the Mercedes suspension in this one.
Yeah, it is a bit higher than I thought it would be. I mean, I could definitely see somebody turning this into a lowrider. Rides a little higher than I expected, but just a great color combo, great body.
It looks like the brakes now have a dual reservoir. Master cylinder.
Yeah. Yeah, so you got power brakes and power steering on this as well. So even better.
You know, a lot of people that are into these cars, it's kind of like, are you into the 59s or the 60s? Which one do you prefer?
Sure.
For me, at least, I prefer the front of the 59, but the back of the 60.
Well, I guess I just had to cut one in half.
Yeah, mix and match.
Yeah, just cut two of them in half, and then you can build your dream car.
Chevys will never be my dream car.
Oh, you got to fear the bow tie, man, yeah. Or the flow tie. The flow tie is even scarier than the bow tie. All right.
Okay, 1970 Plymouth Cuda. This is a Cuda 440, so it has a 444 barrel. What's interesting about these is that the 446 barrel, they made more than the 4 barrel, at least for the hardtop. This is a nice color combination, B5 blue. I guess in 70 to be proper, it would be EB5 blue, white top, white interior, automatic console. What do you want to know about it? I told you a lot, but what strikes you about this car?
Otherwise, where can I find the cheap ones? I would like to know.
In your dreams.
Yeah, this example is a little too nice for me.
This one has AC. This was the biggest engine you can get AC because you couldn't get AC with the 6 barrel.
It's a good looking engine, man.
Yeah, nice and clean.
But, you know, these are cool cars. Someone's going to send me hate mail, but Cudas don't ride very well. They're kind of cheap inside.
I don't think somebody could hate on you for a Cuda. I personally prefer the Challenger, similar body style, but slightly different in proportions. I think the Cuda or Challenger is 2.5 inches longer.
Something like that. Wheelbase.
Right, wheelbase-wise. But the same general body shape as far as the rear haunch and stuff goes.
What I always liked about the Cudas is where the parking lights are, which were tucked underneath the top of the grill, kind of where you can see the lanyard of the hood pins. That's where the parking lights are. I just I always thought that was a neat touch. Otherwise, I'm not into pony cars as much as mid-sized cars, like let's say Roadrunner GTX. But Cudas could be interesting. Is this the way I look? Is this the kind of Cuda I'd look for? Probably not. I kind of get bored with the B5 Blue, but I think this is a nice one nonetheless, and it is on Auction Hunter right now.
Yeah, so all of these cars, but when depending on when you watch this video, all these cars should be on the auction site currently. So this is the one I chose. This is a 1950 Dodge Wayfarer.
I almost chose this one.
This is a beautiful car. Between the blue and then this gorgeous interior, and the fact that it's a convertible, I think is the main reason I chose it. Because when I look at this car, for one, it's a two-door convertible, which is gorgeous. And then just looking at it, just to me screams like cruiser. Like I can picture, like the minute I saw this car, I immediately pictured myself like driving down like PCH type of thing. And this is just a beautiful cruiser. It's not anything crazy. It's got a 230 cubic inch inline six, and it's paired with a 3-speed manual transmission. Nothing crazy. It even looks like a single barrel carb. So again, you're not pushing out crazy horsepower or anything, but I think if you just put the top down and just enjoy your driving experience, be a pretty nice car to drive. So I thought this was a cool one that I'd like to highlight.
Yeah, because you don't want to get anywhere when you're cruising in a hurry anyway. You know, you just want to enjoy it.
Right. Yeah. Certainly not a car to drive in a hurry, but just a really pretty car, especially with the massive white tires, which fun fact, did you guys know that tires used to be white? And then the only reason they're black now is because of a added durability agent.
I didn't know about the durability agent part, but
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that, but rubber is white when it comes out of the tree. And so tires were originally white way back in, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, when they were building tires. But then they decided they were deteriorating too fast, and so they added a durability agent, and now the tires are black. So that black is technically the natural sort of coating. Whether that's still the case today, because obviously tire technology has come a long way. I don't know if there's some other bits, along with maybe a little bit of dyeing to keep some consistency in terms of what the black looks like. I don't know, but thought that was a fun thing to share. So, you know, for all we know, I guess the white wall part could technically just be pure rubber on top of a regular tire.
Now, you had mentioned something about the doors, saying two doors, you like two door convertibles.
Absolutely.
Did you really mean it's a two seater or maybe there's no back seat?
Well, so what I did want to mention is the fact that this has the bench seat. So it's another cruiser aspect. But for me personally, just the whole two door look, I think if you're going to drive a convertible, it should be a two-door.
But most convertibles are two-doors.
Most of them are. I think they look really ungainly when they're not. So it almost seems like it would be a, like even the SUVs that are bigger, the
Murano
Cross Cabriolet and stuff like that are no good. Even the Evoque, is the Evoque is the one that's
Yeah.
That's,
I think the first generation Evoque, they made the convertible.
Yeah, God, I just think they're fairly ungainly. So, yeah, it has to be a two-door for me to remotely care about it, which, yes, most are, but
I think four-door convertibles like from the 40s and before are kind of neat, though. Maybe that's what something I'll bring next week.
They have some of their flair. Yeah, sure. And I think this is also a pretty good demonstration of some of the vehicles we have on Not100.com currently, because if we keep going, we have some newer vehicles even, right?
Yeah, newer and definitely more powerful. So this is the 2002 Camaro SS 35th Anniversary Edition. So this marked the end of the line for the fourth gen Camaro, as well as the Camaro as a whole until 2010. And this is one of those cars, you know, when I was growing up and even until recently, I would look at, you know, older guys and, you know, their love of like 60s muscle cars. And I'd think, oh, well, you know, that seems like something unique to them. But now I'm of an age where this car is more than 20 years old. And this brings me back to when I was in high school because I graduated in 02. So this is kind of that same, this is the same car, but for me, you know, because when I was in high school, you know, there were some kids that had this generation of Camaro. So it does take me back. This one, you know, it's got the 35th anniversary appearance package and the special, you know, floor mats and decals and stripes and all that kind of stuff. Under the hood, you've got a LS1, 5.7 liter V8.
Introduction of the LS.
Yeah, nice and, you know, modern icon, 325 horsepower, and this one's hooked up to a 6-speed manual. So great combination. And only 10,000 miles on this one.
Yeah, and I believe we actually have its sibling. I believe there was also a WS6 Firebird. However, I think that Firebird's early and not a LS car.
Yeah, I don't remember on that one, but I think it's like the blue or purple one with the stripes on it.
It might be black.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what's interesting about these is a facelifted car because the early Camaros were generally called the catfish Camaros for this big intake. Is usually empty, but is obviously has a fill-in plate here with the SS badging and some of the different headlights for the facelifted model, which I think improved the looks a lot by getting rid of some of that. Now, whether it would have been better off with a Chevy flow tie, we may never know. But
yeah, I'm struggling to find where you could actually put one, because I mean, you could put, you know,
oh, just remove the SS badging, put a flow tie there.
Yeah, but then it would just be, you know, it would be blocked off behind it.
The big panel here on the front nose looks like it's blocking a lot of airflow that I think could be improved by adding multiple flow ties.
Oh, you know, you could put I was thinking you could put one in the hood scoop area.
Oh yeah,
but like
several,
the flow tie would be interrupting the airflow.
Yeah, a little bit it would.
Yeah, maybe you should just build an entire car and call it the flow tie. The whole car is just shaped like a bow tie. All right, last car on Auto Hunter.
Okay. The 1956, this is a 57 Volkswagen, and this kind of goes back to the semaphore thing. You see those parking lights by the headlights? Those were mandated by the U.S. government. I think 56 was the first year, 57 definitely, and 58 is the first year for the fender top parking lights. So I remember as a kid seeing a yellow one around town, and I was like, what is this? And I only saw it a few times, but that's when I began to realize, as a, let's say, a fledgling automotive enthusiast, that there was something to these cars that was a little bit more than what I had experienced. Also with the older ones, the brake lights are a little bit lower, kind of interesting to me as a kid,
and definitely before the regulations of everything having to be at a set height,
right?
That would then go and alter what we know as current design languages and stuff like that.
So what's so we have the gauge here because I don't remember the year, 59 maybe 58. There's no gas gauge. when you sputtered, now let's make a distinction. When you sputtered because there was no more fuel versus sputtering because it's a Volkswagen, you just pull a handle and then there would be a reserve tank which would help you get to the gas station. That's how they did it.
Wow, that sounds like such an... I guess if you were going to do something and you knew you had to be at the wedding on Sunday at 10, you could make sure to fill up if you're like, well, it's been a little while and I don't want to do that on my way to the wedding. So I guess there's other ways to get around that, but boy, does that seem like that could really inconvenience you like a lot. Like if you're on the freeway and like you thought you had a full tank and then you just start driving and then it starts sputtering and you're like, whoa, I'm, you know, 15 plus miles from the nearest gas tank.
Or imagine being in Nevada in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden you're sputtering. You got to pull that handle and you don't know if you're going to make it to the next gas station. It's like a Tesla before Tesla.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is this one has a rack on top, so you can carry a gas can.
Just fill it up with jerry cans.
I don't like the accessories. It kind of looks goofy to me.
So accessories is what I was going to say. It's one of the coolest things I've seen with this. I went to a car show where they had a older Beetle, and it had a trailer from Sears from like out of the catalog. And then it also had a supercharger, a period correct supercharger on it. Yeah. Wow. I think total the car only made like 58 horsepower with the supercharger, so it's not like it was, you know, gapping things per se. It just sputtered along slightly faster than the other Volkswagens.
So that Beetle couldn't fly, you're saying?
Yeah, that Beetle might have issues flying. But pretty interesting vehicles. It's the prices for these are actually surprising. While they're still very affordable, there's also a lot of select models that are worth considerably more than the others. And they built, obviously, like what?
Millions.
I was going to say, I was sketchy to say millions. I know it was at least 1 million, which is a crazy number of vehicles.
Not so much for the earlier cars. I mean, the split window that you had, I don't know how many they made that year,
which
I mean,
is still US,
probably just a couple thousand, but I mean, what, 100,000 worldwide or even 50,000? I don't know, but you know, by 57, you know, it's a lot more, not like what we're used to, but still.
Do you know if this is the same size as the regular split window, just without the spine, or is it? Because it's the same general shape.
I think it may be. And I want to say the last of the split windows was 52, but I don't quote me on that.
Not a Volkswagen guy either. Volkswagens and Cadillacs aren't really my main focus. I like a lot of the Volkswagen sub-brands. Huh. Just not Volkswagen that much. But pretty cool cars. So with that, that's going to be a highlight. All of these vehicles that we showed here at the end are actually all currently live on AutoHunter.com, which is our online auction. And these are not the only vehicles live. We have tons of vehicles that go live every single weekday. So if you're looking to buy or sell your collector car, be sure to check that out online. And if you enjoyed the video, could hit that like button for us. We'd really appreciate it. And we're, of course, always looking for your feedback. If you want to let us know if there's anything we can improve in the comment section down below, or what you thought of our current topics, or have any suggestions for future episodes. And if you enjoyed it, make sure you get subscribed so you can see these videos as we release these regularly. And thank you to Derek and Diego for joining me once again. So with that, thank you so much for watching. We'll see you guys next time.